This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry, and since you find us on the podcast, we know you are discerning listeners. Let's get to it. Here's today's show. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And we can take you directly into the sound of what it feels like to experience a 7.8 magnitude earthquake, as the people of Nepal and the trekkers on Everest did Saturday.
The ground is shaking. Come under my jacket. Come under my jacket. Are you okay?
Yeah.
You all right? Yeah.
Yeah.
The sounds now of people in Nepal by the millions, still counting the thousands of dead and feeling the forces deep within the earth still shaking their devastated cities and villages.
It took everyone by surprise.
The tremor was there full day, whole day. Every 30 minutes the tremor was coming.
And people flooded out of the shops. The street was filled. People were grabbing each other.
We stayed outside the hotel on the ground.
And once it finished, there was just floods of people just running to open spaces.
My God, immediately, tell me, come with me. It just protects us and push us out on the ground and really save our life. Because everything goes, dust on us, we couldn't breathe, and it was horrible.
We take you now to Kathmandu and Alina Shresh, the communications manager for one of the major NGOs involved in the relief efforts along with the United Nations, World Vision. Alina, thanks for taking the time to speak with us. And what would you say are the key challenges for Nepal as we begin this week?
The key challenges for us would be to get to areas which are inaccessible in Nepal. It is not just the Kathmandu Valley that has been affected and impacted by the major earthquake that took place on Saturday. It's the neighboring districts, which are hilly districts and inaccessible roads.
And how many people do you think are at risk if you look at the map and add up the populations?
Well, as of now, we have the information from UN that around 35 out of 75 districts in Nepal has been affected, and the population for that would be 6 million people impacted by the earthquake.
And as communications manager, how difficult is getting communications across all of that area and to monitor the status of 6 million people?
Oh, well, the radio is doing its part on informing people, but we as an organization, we work only in 11 districts of Nepal, so we are trying to communicate as much as we can to ensure the safety of our staff and to find out and do the assessments.
And what are the food shortages, the questions of time ticking, issues of exposure? What are people, the experts at World Vision, telling you about how much time and how important time is at this point?
Well, time is very important. We already have begun our distribution today in one of the affected districts within the Kathmandu Valley. We are distributing 10,000 tarps and 600 blankets for people who have lost their homes. So, yes, it's very important.
And what about your family and the family of aid workers who are in the area? So many people are both involved in the rescue effort and concerned about their own families. Are you one of those?
Yes. It's not an easy task to be away from your family when we've been receiving aftershocks. Yesterday, we received a major aftershock at around 1 p.m., and it was like an earthquake. It was like similar to an earthquake. And I have a five-year-old boy who's been panic-stricken. So, yes, my heart is at home, whereas I'm in the office working to ensure our relief efforts.
What are these aftershocks feeling like?
They feel like an earthquake, exactly like an earthquake. And yes, there have been many, many aftershocks. My family and I have been sleeping in tents since we faced the major earthquake on Saturday. And in my house, we have around 50 people who've come to take temporary shelter because of the open space, the little garden that I have.
We're talking with Alina Shrestha, who's communications manager for World Vision in Nepal. She's on the line from Kathmandu. How has the medical infrastructure been affected as far as you can tell? Are hospitals working? Are doctors able to be mobile? Are people able to come to clinics? Are mobile clinics being setting up? All of those questions.
Yes, our hospitals do not have the capacity to respond. So we have heard news of mobile clinics being set up even on football grounds because a lot of patients are being treated on pavements and the hospitals are running out on medical supplies as well. Yes, so mobile clinics are being set up.
What's your main goal for the next 24 hours?
At the moment, what we are doing is assessing the needs of people in a very badly affected district of Nepal, which was the epicenter called Gorkha. So our teams are there and we're trying to find out their needs within this 24 hours and even distributing whatever we have at hand. Like I said, 1,000 tarps and 600 blankets to the people who are in need, dire need of shelter today.
Alina Shrestha is a communications manager for World Vision on the line from Kathmandu. Thanks so much, Alina.
Thank you.
Support for The Takeaway comes from PBS, featuring the Oscar-nominated documentary Last Days in Vietnam, on American experience. Directed and produced by Rory Kennedy, including first-person accounts and new footage, Tuesday at 9, 8 Central on PBS. The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. And the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International, in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
So the anger continues to boil in Baltimore. Thousands of protesters took to the streets of the city this weekend over the death of African-American Freddie Gray, a 25-year-old black man who died in police custody this month. In parts of the city, protests got violent, with storefront windows smashed in, bottles and rocks thrown, police in riot gear made a dozen arrests. Mayor Stephanie Rawlings-Blake held a late-night news conference with Freddie Gray's twin sister and several others. She called for calm.
I have and I will continue to support the vast majority of the demonstrators who are exercising their right to peaceful protest. But we cannot and will not let a minority of incendiary individuals exploit the honorable intentions of those trying to exercise their rights.
As we look at the Baltimore situation and try to put it in the context of other incidents over the last year, 2 years, are we seeing the emergence of a far more visible debate and sense of public accountability for police actions regarding brutality and treatment of African-American citizens? Or are we seeing the escalation to an all-out cultural war between citizens and law enforcement? With us in our studio is Peter Moskos, former Baltimore cop, now associate professor at John Jay College of Criminal Justice. Also on the line is Lester Spence, professor of political science and Africana studies at Johns Hopkins University, author of Stare in the Darkness, The Limits of Hip Hop and Black Politics. So, Lester Spence, what do you think is going on here?
So just a few numbers. Baltimore has paid out approximately $6 million since 2011 in lawsuits against people alleging police brutality. There was a period of time when O'Malley, who's now a potential presidential candidate, was mayor, in which they made over 700,000 arrests, and the city of Baltimore itself only has approximately 640,000 people. And the census tract that Gray lived in had spent approximately $47 million on incarceration. So I think that what we're witnessing is kind of a catalytic moment, if you will, in which people are just increasingly frustrated with what they feel to be anti-black policing.
Would you say, though, that this discussion is a sign of a more visible debate over accountability for police, or are we just seeing a devolving into a kind of war here?
I think it is. There are a number of different forms it can take, right? So people have been focusing on the violence, but it's important to note that if you look at something like 1992, the Los Angeles rebellions, there was about $1 billion in property damage. 2,000 people were injured. And for what I understand, there are maybe a dozen arrests and probably not more than I'd say $10,000 in property damage. So we're probably not looking at a war. We're looking at people who are frustrated, and people are doing a lot of organizing here in Ferguson and elsewhere to kind of create a more humane police department, more humane mode of policing.
Peter Moskos, would you say this is a natural process with some positive implications, even given the unfortunate death of Freddie Gray?
I hope so. Certainly, it's in everybody's interest to have better policing. And to some extent, attention on police departments, even when it's received very negatively by police officers, that often leads to better policing. I hope we see that here. Baltimore has historically remained a bit isolated. What happens in Baltimore stays in Baltimore. And there are incredible social problems there that go beyond the police department. I do wish we could talk about the issues more before someone is killed. These issues aren't going away.
How do we do that? And Lester, I want your help on this. How do we do that before? We don't need to wait for a death to have these kinds of discussions. Peter, first you, and then Lester.
I'm happy to turn this over to Lester, but I do want to add one thing to what he said to add on that. When I was down there as a police officer in 2000, and the numbers have declined a bit, in the Eastern District, we made 20,000 arrests in a year. There were only 42,000 people living there. If you don't live or work in these neighborhoods, they're too easy to ignore. What we saw, not just with the demonstrators, but with the violent part of the demonstrators, we saw a little bit of the ghetto get out of the ghetto. And at some point, without the violence, I wish that could happen
more.
U.S.
police saw that? Ghetto get out of the
ghetto? I think America saw that.
Uh-huh.
We just don't see those neighborhoods where Freddie Gray lived. The problems there are immense, and we have to deal with them. I think the unfortunate part is we as Americans, as society, have these problems, and then we put police in there to deal with them, and then when they make mistakes, we blame them. But the problems go beyond the police.
Lester.
Yeah. Excellent points. I think that what it's going to take is, I mean, what's already happening, right? People have been organizing against this issue, against police brutality, but they've been organizing against the type of two societies we see in Baltimore for decades, far longer than I've been here. And what it is going to require, yeah, I don't see a way around it, right? Moments like these give the rest of the society the only glimpse into the organizing that's actually been done. If something like this doesn't happen, people are just going to ignore it.
But can we make these discussions higher visibility prior to an event like this? Think preventively. Is there a way to do that, Lester, politically and in terms of, relations with law enforcement?
I understand the question. And I consider myself to be pretty decent at what I do. And I'd say I'm fortunately the answer is if history is any guide, the answer is no. We don't see massive spending in South Central Los Angeles until after the 1992 rebellion. We don't see massive spending in Detroit until after the 1967 rebellion. We don't see massive spending in Baltimore had a rebellion after King was assassinated. You go to those neighborhoods, and a number of them haven't been changed.
Mm.
Peter, so I think that's what we're looking at.
I'll give you the last word, Peter.
I'm perhaps equally non-optimistic, but I do think we also have to separate the concept of legitimate rebellion from just, young idiots breaking things and causing violence. I don't see that as the same, and at some point, we do have to maintain order. The whole concept of this being simply a rebellion, I think, is a little simplistic.
Although there are lots of African-American commentators and others who say that, the story of developing greater trust with authority and with vulnerable populations in the United States is sometimes a violent story, even though it's also a story of vigorous debate and civic organizing as well. Peter Moskos, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And Lester Spence, professor of political science and Africana studies at Johns Hopkins University, author of Stare in the Darkness, Limits of Hip Hop and Black Politics. Peter Moskos, a former Baltimore cop, now associate professor at John Jay College of Criminal Justice. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
The Takeaway is supported by Lumosity.com. Brain training designed by neuroscientists that has been used by 60 million people worldwide. With personalized training programs to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving. Learn more at Lumosity.com.
lived so many places. Let me give you another one of these zip odes. Cool shoes, extremely high rents, uncool hood. In fact, you might call it 10021%. The few years I spent on Manhattan's Upper East Side, right? Or this, on River Grande, not in the sticks, home of President Gerry Ford. Oh, right, great burritos, 49506. For National Poetry Month, our friends at WLRN and the O Miami Poetry Festival have another great idea this year, Zip Odes, poems inspired by your zip codes. But theirs and yours that we're getting are much more sophisticated than mine. 5 lines for each digit in your zip code, and the number of words in each line is the number in the code. Get it? You do.
My name is Karen, and I live in Clarkdale, Arizona. My zip code is 86324, and this is my zip ode. The gorgeous, multicolored red rock mountain views shimmer in the ever-changing sunset colors, soon to be spoiled by a future cell tower. My poem is about my own view from my home, which is gorgeous red rock views of Sedona, Arizona, and the town of Clarkdale is proposing to approve a cell tower 400 feet from my home, right in the middle of my view. So I'm in the middle of a fight. Wish me well.
This is just one of hundreds we've been getting. A very serious effort here from the middle of America.
My name is Jill, and I live in St. Louis, Missouri. My zip code is 63116, and this is my zip ode. You've heard of us. Ferguson-related protests, tear gas, windows broken. A promise, here all lives matter. This poem was inspired by my South City community's response to the Ferguson grand jury decision last November and to the street protests that made national news. There's much work to be done to fulfill this promise that all lives matter, but I'm proud to live in a diverse, caring neighborhood where many people do speak up for justice. We're working constructively to make this promise come true.
In Hawaii, fewer anxieties, but more words.
My name's Louise, and I live in Princeville on the island of Kauai in Hawaii. My zip code is 96722, and this is my zip ode. Below us, humpbacks, dolphins, turtles share their Pacific playground. Above us, albatross chase the wind. Princeville, a tropical paradise fed by water. No rain, no rainbows. My poem is about just a few of nature's gifts in the ocean and the air that surround us in Princeville, perched along the cliffs of Kauai's beautiful North Shore.
And here, different view, but worth the rent?
My name is Patty, and I live in New York, New York. My zip code is 10024, and this is my zip ode. Waiting for the rent to go up. My poem is about an increasingly daunting aspect of renting in New York City, which is that your rent can be raised to a market value that represents a market of which you are not a part. But until that happens, you enjoy every minute.
Zip Odes, tell us about the promises of your hometown, its natural beauty, its annoyances. Head over to our website at thetakeaway.org to submit a poem or leave us a message at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
The Takeaway is supported by Citrix, creator of GoToMeeting, connecting people and businesses in face-to-face online meetings from any device, featuring a personalized meeting room for a custom look. Learn more at GoToMeeting.com.
In some sense, you could say that the beginning of the national mood shift and political revolution regarding same-sex marriage began with a bit of bothersome paperwork back in 1975. Two men walked into the Boulder, Colorado County Clerk's office and asked clerk Clela Rorex for a marriage license. She couldn't think of a good reason not to give them one, and so she did and helped start something that 40 years later involves some much more historic paperwork. The Supreme Court is hearing arguments this week in a case expected to finally decide the issue of same-sex marriage as a constitutional question. She's retired today, but Clela Rorex never expected that a county clerk's decision would raise issues for the highest court in the land.
I just had taken office in January of 75, and I don't think I really knew anyone who was gay or lesbian at the time. So these two guys that first came to my office were not from Boulder. They were from Colorado Springs, which is a hotbed of conservatism. And they went to the county clerk there first to ask for a marriage license. And she said, oh, we don't do that kind of thing here. Go to Boulder. So that is how they ended up on my doorstep.
And your response to them was?
Well, they told me why they wanted to be married, and it had something to do with them qualifying for the Homestead Act, which sounded reasonable to me. And I sought the opinion of our district attorney. He read our Colorado marriage code. The ordinance at the time did not prohibit issuing licenses to two people of the same sex. It just didn't address it in our marriage code. And so if I wanted to do this, I was within my legal right to offer the license.
So there's the question of, did you want to do this? There's the question of, did you think it was the right thing to do? There's the question of, if there's no law preventing it, maybe you're supposed to. How did you think about it?
This is where it kind of gets confusing for even me, because people expect me to say something kind of profound. But the truth is, to me, it was simply, here were two people who were asking for a legal right. I was an active feminist at the time. We were asking for legal rights. To me, there just wasn't any difference. And the very core of me said, I'm not the person to discriminate if two people of the same sex want to get married. And that was pretty much my thinking. If other people are seeking equal rights, why not all people? And I just made the decision to do it. And if the law did not prohibit me issuing same-sex marriage licenses, then I truly felt that I should do so.
And clearly, you don't think that's profound?
I think I learned later that it was profound. I can't tell you how naive I was at the time. You have to understand I was pretty young, 31, and I hadn't had a lot of exposure to many other places, and certainly not to the gay and lesbian community. And it was very simple for me, a question of, am I going to be the one to take away such a right if this right exists? And I could never have lived with that. I didn't know at the time how strongly I felt about that. I often say I grew into it, because as years went on, all I could think about was, I am so glad I made that decision that I did.
Now, do you stay in touch with any of the couples who were part of that history-making set of decisions that you made back in 1975?
About 30 years later, I was contacted by one of the couples, Tony Sullivan and Richard Adams, who did stay together for over 40 years before Richard passed away in December of 2012. And I am so, so happy that I did. I saw how they were together. I saw how meaningful that marriage license was to them. And it brought it home full circle that I saw a couple who stayed together for all those years, feeling deeply that they were married.
And it certainly puts a different spin on the, you know, mindless paperwork that you think of when you think of a county clerk.
Yes, it does. You know, you just don't think that somebody in an administrative level of government like that really can be called upon sometimes to make important decisions. And even if you look at things now, with the Supreme Court soon to hear once again whether marriage equality will be the law of the land, you see administrative officials, county clerks, and others putting up all kinds of roadblocks to try to not issue licenses to same-sex couples. You see administrative officials saying they're not going to change the gender on a driver's license or on a birth certificate. It's petty. Government officials, I feel, get hamstrung with red tape, and they should find a way around it. it's not like you're asking for the impossible.
So what do you think of the debate now around the Supreme Court?
Well, my toes and fingers are crossed. It just has to go forward. We cannot have piecemeal civil rights in our country. And to me, marriage equality is a civil rights issue. It's a human rights issue.
Well, Kalila, it's been great talking to you. Thanks so much.
You're very welcome.
Kalila Rorix is a former Boulder County, Colorado clerk who gave marriage licenses to six same-sex couples back in 1975. Tomorrow, we're continuing our discussion of same-sex marriage with David Michener, a plaintiff in the Obergefell v. Hodges case that goes before the Supreme Court this week. That's tomorrow on The Takeaway. Coming up, what do you think it means to come out as transgender? Do you have transgender people in your life? If you could ask them anything, what would it be? From San Francisco, California, I do have several transgender acquaintances, and I admire their courage. Here are some thoughts. A, an individual's own gender identity is not my business. B, gender is complicated, obviously, and there appears to be more than two distinct boxes. C, I can let a person be the expert on their own gender identity. Who am I to say who someone is? I.e., I know what it intrinsically feels like for me to be male. Can someone else have the same certainty? Surely. Therefore, I can take people at face value and love them for who they are. Thoughtful comment there from San Francisco.
Hi, this is Riley Ashton from DFW. How do you, as a transgender person, manage the separation from who you are and who everyone around you expects you to be?
This is Lori from Salt Lake City, and my question would be, what can I do to be a better ally and help you feel more comfortable in this world?
Share your questions. Would they be different than Diane Sawyer's? Call 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's our number, or tweet us at The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from PBS, featuring the Oscar-nominated documentary Last Days in Vietnam, on American Experience. Directed and produced by Rory Kennedy, including first-person accounts and new footage, Tuesday at 9, 8 Central on PBS.
Almost 40 years after his historic and what most people would say his most masculine of moments, Bruce Jenner, who won the gold medal in the 1976 Olympic decathlon, told Diane Sawyer on Friday night that he is a woman.
Am I saying goodbye to something? I'm saying goodbye to people's perception of me and who I am. I'm not saying goodbye to me because this has always been me.
Jenner has always existed in a netherworld of tabloid publicity and Hollywood B-listers. He was close to people in the O.J. Simpson trial. His lively family and his connection with the Kardashians has kept him in the headlines. But what do people in the transgender community think of this moment on the ABC News program 2020? Joining us are Grace Stevens, author of No, Maybe, Yes, Living My Truth. Also with us is Sarah Schnorr, attorney and advocate. Both are transgender. Grace and Sarah, welcome.
Hi, thank you.
What part of your story, Grace, and then Sarah, provides an opportunity for empathy, connects you with the rest of the world that might otherwise shun you, Grace?
For me, I think the story was the internal battle for 60 years and the denial. And I transitioned at the age of 64, and until I was 63, I could not even admit to myself, even though I knew there were gender issues all over the place, I could not say to myself, I am transsexual. That would just make it real. And it took me well over 60 years to go through the internal battle. And my story is one that I hope people understand their own internal battles to be who they truly are.
Sarah?
I think the best part of my story is trying to look at it in hindsight. As difficult as my transition was, and I struggled with the same issues that Grace did. I transitioned a few years earlier than Grace at age 61. At the time, a partner in a huge law firm. But the thing that I learned when I came out to one of my 80-year-old Irish Catholic aunts, and about 10 minutes into my story, she looked at me and she said, "What happened to your nervous cough?" I said, "What nervous cough?" She said, "I've known you for 60 years. Every minute you have this cough and have to clear your throat. It's gone." And I said, "Wow." I said, "Well, I guess now I'm finally at ease with myself, so I don't need to have this little nervous tick. I'm now able to relate to my relatives, my parents, to my aunts and my uncles, to my wife and children much more openly and honestly than I ever was before I transitioned. And I think that vulnerability that I've been able to share with people around me that I love is what really has humanized my transition for them.
Possibly the best statement I've ever heard of why it's more easier, perhaps, more meaningful to come out to an 80-year-old Irish aunt than to someone like Diane Sawyer. but both work.
The cookies were very good that she shared with me.
So what do you think, Grace, of the significance of Bruce Jenner's interview and his profile and just anything that you heard on Friday night?
It's a fabulous opportunity for the transgender community to be visible throughout the 17 million people that watch that show, and I have no idea how many have seen it over the internet now. So visibility is very important as a first step to learn who we really are.
Sarah, is there a right kind of visibility and a wrong kind of visibility? And what do you think about the events of Friday night?
That's a very challenging question. There is no one right kind of visibility. We are a community, and yet we are each unique individuals. Each one of us is different. Each one of us has a different story. The big concern that the transgender community had prior to that interview was that it would be sensationalized, and I was pleased that the interview did not reinforce stereotypes.
Let me play you one part of the interview where Diane Sawyer asked what could certainly be called a provocative question. He asked Bruce Jenner about sexual reassignment surgery, specific details about transition, as it's called. Listen.
There's no rush for that. And I would do it so quietly, nobody in the world would ever know. Term SRS, sexual reassignment surgery, would be down the line.
Should she have asked that, Sarah?
I would have preferred her not to ask that question because, after all, gender and the way in which we express that gender to the world is totally different from our sexuality and what's between our legs. When I was dealing with the issues surrounding my gender transition, the last thing on my mind was sex. I was really dealing with my gender and how I was going to express that gender within the world and communities that I live and work in.
Grace, did you relate to his story about family and being uncomfortable, worrying about how family was going to think of this decision and the timing of the decision and his religious candor at all, Grace?
I definitely related to the issue about family and really wanting not to hurt anybody. But that's a challenge that everybody goes through of how do I be true to myself and yet hold all my responsibilities together?
As an Olympian in 1976, he's come a long way from that very, I don't know, masculine designation of being a decathlon winner. And I'm wondering if you're concerned, and now, you know, he's on this Diane Sawyer interview and taking this particular decision. Are you concerned that people are going to go, oh, another crazy thing with a crazy guy named Bruce Jenner, that this transgender issue is trivialized by his very celebrity profile here, Grace?
I don't think it's going to be trivialized. I think that the real challenge is for people who may not understand this to be open to learning to understand it. The reality is change is constant and each individual changes all the time. You know, the view that I have is that he wants some privacy so he can go move into the next step of his life.
As far as privacy is concerned, we can assess whether Bruce Jenner is going to get much privacy after this exchange, which is pretty interesting.
But not to get political, I've just never been a big fan of kind of more on the conservative side.
Are you a Republican?
Yeah. Is that a bad thing? I believe in the Constitution.
No. You think that it will be maybe unsettling thing for some people in the conservative wing of the Republican Party?
I've thought about that.
Are you going to go to Mitch McConnell and John Boehner and ask them to help champion this cause?
I would do that, yeah, in a heartbeat. Why not? Yeah. And I think they'd be very receptive to it.
What do you think about him being a conservative spokesperson for the transgender community?
Transgender people like Grace, like me, we cover the gamut politically, socially, economically, in terms of career-wise. I'm very liberal, very progressive, But I have many friends in the trans community who are culturally and certainly economically very conservative. Grace?
Yeah. Being transgender is an equal opportunity position. It impacts all people across all cultures, all political beliefs. It's done this throughout time, throughout history. It's just part of human population.
Sarah Schnorr and Grace Stevens, thank you so much.
Thank you, John.
Thank you, John.
And one more thing to take with you today.
There's a lot of buzz around social entrepreneurship, technology. People are finding ways, despite the gloom and doom around Pakistan, to actually forge ahead and do interesting things.
It's the brave voice of women's rights and hackathon activist Sabine Mahmood, who founded a group in Pakistan dedicated to religious tolerance and peaceful conflict resolution. The Second Floor is her organization's name. We do pretty much what we can get away with, she said bravely last year.
The city that I come from, which is Karachi, it has the dubious honor of being termed as one of the world's most dangerous megacities. It's, you know, racked by crime. We do suffer from a lack of infrastructure. We don't really have an enabling environment where creative people can actually flourish.
Last Friday night, outside a place she made for free and open dialogue, gunmen in Karachi targeted her and critically injured her mother. Courageous Sabine was murdered at the young age of 40. Let's think about that today. That's all for you. You can respond to anything you heard on today's program at thetakeaway.org or call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
PRI, Public Radio International.